This hour, we'll take your phone calls with the theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss. His book, Write It Down, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? We'll be back with Lawrence, your calls, and chat more about the universe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Lawrence Krauss, with us. Lawrence, the black holes, wormholes, are they one and the same, or are they different?
Well, they're different. Black holes, as far as we can tell, seem to exist. First of all, the gravitational waves we've seen from colliding objects billions of light years away behave as exactly as if they were black holes colliding, 30, 40 solar mass black holes. They appear to be huge million or billion solar mass black holes at the center of galaxies. Wormholes, however, are sort of speculated objects within general relativity that connect distant points in space, like a tunnel. If you take a piece of paper and bend it around and make a little tunnel, then two points, which otherwise you'd have to go all the way around the piece of paper to connect, can actually be connected with this little tunnel. Those objects are hypothetical, and in fact, it turns out that if normal matter is all there is, you can't make any wormholes, because the mouth of each wormhole, at each end of the wormhole, will actually collapse to form its own black hole in a time scale shorter than you go through the wormhole. So the only way there could be traversable wormholes in the universe of the type that, say, Jodie Foster went through in Contact.
That's right.
Would be if there was, again, new types of energy. And we simply don't know if those energy types of energy can be created. There's lots of evidence that it would be very difficult to create them. So black holes are real. They're very exotic. Nothing light can escape from them and classically. And when you fall in, you get crushed. And all of the wonderful things that cause black holes to be such staples of science fiction. Those objects appear to exist, and I say appear because all we can say is the objects we see in the sky kind of walk like black holes and quack like black holes, so they are probably black holes, but we really don't know for certain. They're just so compact, millions or billions of times the mass of the sun contained in a region so small that our theories say that the only way that could form an object is a black hole. So those are real wormholes, probably not.
Through a wormhole, could you pop out into another universe?
Well, if there was a wormhole, you could pop out into a distant region of our universe, or potentially into something you might want to call another universe, a region of space that's so far away that it isn't causally connected to our universe. So wormholes are very exotic and delightful, which is why we would like them to exist, but once again, as I say, the universe is the way it is, whether we like it or not. And wormholes, as exotic as they sound, just simply may not exist, because once again, you can't make a wormhole without some exotic type of energy that we've never seen on Earth.
When you were a young boy, I bet you were interested in science and had a telescope and did all those great things we did when we were kids.
Sure, I had a telescope, I had a chemistry set.
Perfect.
I think kids should play with science. That's why I write books, and I think we should be... Too many people think that science... You know, it's kind of funny. They think, well, you know, I can enjoy music without being Eric Clapton, and I can enjoy painting without being Pablo Picasso, but I can't enjoy science unless I'm a scientist. But we can all enjoy the universe. We're all born scientists. I mean, kids... Babies are born scientists. They're exploring their world every day, and we kind of beat it out of kids in school, and it's sort of unfortunate because it's fascinating and it's fun, and even if you can't master it, you can still appreciate it.
Sure can. Where were you born, Lawrence?
Well, I was born in New York City, but I moved very quickly to Canada when I was 3 months old, and I grew up in Toronto in Canada. And
Toronto's a great town.
Yeah, and I didn't come back to the United States until I went to graduate school at MIT. And I didn't even know I was an American at the time. It wasn't until I was at Harvard a few years later that I discovered I was an American.
Yeah, you were born here. You sure are.
Well, I wish the customs officials had told me, immigration officials had told me that when I moved to the States, when instead they said I needed a visa.
Are we ever going to get to the point where science will solve some of these political ills that are capturing all of us around this country and this world?
Well, I think, and that's one of the sort of side benefits of the book that I wrote. I think science has allowed us to uncover the reality behind the illusions of the universe that we see, the real true nature of the universe. And science is not just a collection of facts, like we often teach in school. It's a process for deriving facts. And it's a process that's based on skepticism and empirical inquiry and testing and checking your sources. All of those things, those tools, which we should be teaching students in school, instead of pretending to try and fill their minds with facts, we should be teaching them how to question appropriately. Those tools, I think, are an essential part of a healthy democracy. Those are the tools we need to cut through the garbage that politicians say. We can demand the evidence for why what their claims are, and then test that evidence. And so I think that those tools of science can be incredibly useful in a democracy, to have informed voters determining to have informed legislators. In fact, I fear for our democracy unless we can basically train people to be skeptical and demand evidence instead of only listening to those things that appeal to the things, to the beliefs they had beforehand, but instead being willing to quote and say, is this really true? How can I check it? And if someone's telling me something that sounds good, maybe I should be suspicious.
I think you're right. Let's take some calls as they line up here for you. First time caller, David, truck driving in Alabama. Welcome to the show. David, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I love your show.
Thank you.
Long time listener, first time caller. My question for the guest is his theory about the earth and my theory differ. My theory is with the Bible, and I want to know why my theory is considered a fairy tale.
All right. Well, why is the Bible considered a fairy tale, Lawrence?
Well, I don't know what your specific theory is, but theories are theories, and the point is evidence is evidence, and the data and the evidence overwhelmingly tells us, for example, that the Earth is 4.55 billion years old, it formed around shortly after our sun did. The evidence tells us that the Earth never stopped when it would not. First of all, the sun did not stop in the sky when someone blew a horn, because unlike at the time when they thought the sun went around the Earth, the Earth goes around the sun, and the only way the sun could stop in the sky is if the Earth stopped rotating. If the Earth stopped rotating, basically everything on Earth would crumble from the sudden shock. So basically all of the evidence tells us that the things that they tried to talk about in the Bible were explanations based on a time when people didn't understand how the universe worked. And now we can measure and test and we can make predictions about things. And certainly the Earth isn't 6,000 years old. Certainly evolution happened. All of these things happened. And by the way, in fact, which most of the major organized, even churches recognize, because you can't deny the fact that the Earth isn't 6,000 years old. Saying the Earth is 6,000 years old is akin to saying my theory is that the United States is 17 feet across.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a long-distance truck driver, you're quite aware every given day that you test it that the United States is longer than 17 feet. And if someone came up to you and said, no, it's 17 feet, you say, look, drive a car for an hour and you'll discover it's not.
Right.
Similarly, we can do the equivalent of driving a car for an hour and do with many of our tests, and we know the Earth is not 6,000 years old. It's 4.55 billion years old. We know it to 1% accuracy.
What do you think of the flat earthers who really believe the planet is flat?
Well, you know, every day I try and come up with different reasons why these ideas are wrong. For example, again, to your earlier caller, we know one of the reasons we know the Earth and Sun are older than 6,000 years old is an amazing fact that, you know how long it takes light to get from the center of the Sun to the outside of the Sun? 1 million years.
Wow.
If the light keeps bouncing off all the atoms. So if the sun were only 6,000 years old, it wouldn't be shining, first of all. But similarly with the flat Earth, all sorts of reasons that there are 24 time zones, and if it was flat, you wouldn't come back to where you began after 24 time zones. More importantly, I just came back from a trip where I flew around the world. So, you know, I can attest that the world is round because I flew around it and ended up back where I began.
That's a lot of flying, too. It really is. Let's go to our Skype caller, Lyle in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. Welcome to the show. Lyle, you're on the air.
Hi, George. First-time caller.
Thank you, Lyle.
How are you doing?
Good to have you with us. Great. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to say that I agree with Professor Krauss that life on Earth is just happenstance. It collision, basically, I believe it's a bullet hitting a BB. I would like to propose a hypothesis to both of you.
Sure, go ahead.
I'd like to preface it with a quote from myself. I'm a planetary theorist, and I'd like to say that we have been granted the privilege of participating in the abundance of life on this unique and fascinating world. My only hope is that we will all eventually come to realize it. I think that we need to have more reverence for life on Earth, as it is a very much a rarity in the universe. I believe the way life happened was a large comet impacted Mars and threw water everywhere. And when it impacted Mars, Mars was semi-molten at the time, and a portion of its core, its dense core, was spit out, and, you know, to the left and to the right of our solar system. I believe the planet Mercury is part of Mars' core, and out on the right side, spat out, was that asteroid. I believe it's called Psyche or Psyche. And this water was then sort of sucked up like a vacuum cleaner by the planet Earth and Venus.
Well, let's find out from Lawrence about just some of the things you've said. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, it's nice that to believe these things, but the point is that we have lots of evidence which tells us about how where water on the Earth comes from, for example, and we know that there are enough comets and asteroids that have been hitting the Earth over its 4.5 billion year history to actually provide enough water for to fill all the oceans on Earth. There are some issues because it turns out we can also measure what are called the different isotopes, deuterium and hydrogen, in ocean water on Earth. And it's slightly different than the water in many of the comets. So we know there's a class of comets from the outer solar system that probably provided some of the water. But in fact, remarkably, when the Earth formed, and when this is one of the problems with your theory, if something impacted upon Mars enough to make it molten, the water would of course not be, which is incredibly volatile, would be one of the first things to go. Remarkably, when the Earth formed, the temperature in the neighborhood of the Earth was about 1,000 degrees in that part of the solar system. So for a long time, we thought all the water on Earth had to come from distant comets. But now we've learned that water can be trapped deep in rocks. So it's possible that some significant fraction of the water on Earth actually was primordial, was trapped in the rocks in the small rocks that formed the Earth eventually. As far as your notions about Mercury, again, we know that the composition of Mercury is different than the composition of Mars. They formed at different times in different places. But it is true that we have learned from looking at solar systems elsewhere in the universe, in our galaxy, that lots of strange things can happen. Planets can migrate. Giant planets can move from the outer solar system to the inside. Lots of strange and wonderful things can happen. But as I say, your belief is your belief, but it's not consistent with the evidence that we've seen.
You've done some work into the nature of dark matter. Tell us briefly, Lawrence, if you can, just what is dark matter anyway?
Well, we don't know exactly what it's made of, but the remarkable thing is that we can weigh our galaxy. And you might say, how can we do that? And we use gravity, of course. And it turns out we can weigh the Earth by seeing how fast the moon goes around the Earth. We know the distance the moon is from the Earth. And the speed of the moon around the Earth and the fact that it takes 1 month to go around the Earth allows us to weigh the Earth remarkably accurately. Similarly, we can weigh the Sun by knowing the Earth is 93 million miles away from the Sun. It takes a year to go around it. That allows us to weigh the Sun. And we can similarly weigh our galaxy. The Sun goes around our galaxy about every 200 million years at a speed of about 200 kilometers per second. We can use that to weigh our galaxy. But the interesting thing is when we look at objects further out from the center of our galaxy than us, we see that their speed is not consistent with assuming that basically all the matter in our galaxy is equivalent to the light in our galaxy, namely that most of the mass in our galaxy is made of stars.
it appears that there's 10 times more stuff out there than meets the eye, stuff that doesn't shine. And it's true not just for our galaxy, but for all galaxies. And for a long time, and we've still been puzzled about what it might be, but we now have pretty good evidence that it's probably made not of any of the same kind of stuff that makes you and I up, but rather new types of elementary particles, which means that dark matter isn't just out there in the heavens. It's going through this room as I'm talking to you, because it goes right through the Earth without knowing it was there. And we're actually building detectors underground to look for it, or we may discover it at the Large Hadron Collider by producing these particles in collisions in our accelerators. So it's incredibly exciting to think that most of the mass in the universe may be made of something that's different than the material on Earth.
Let's take another call before the break. Nita in Panama City Beach, Florida. Welcome to the show. Nita, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Hi, guys.
Sure.
I'm just curious, when he said that he doesn't believe that there's life after this life, does he have an opinion on when it comes to psychics or people speaking to people that have passed and they know things they shouldn't
know? Mediums and things like that.
Yes, and near-death experiences and things that they wouldn't have any way of knowing anything unless they were communicating with someone in an afterlife.
I would guess that you do not believe in mediums and speaking to the afterlife because you don't believe in the afterlife, Lawrence. But go ahead.
Well, it's not. I use belief.
Yeah.
Belief. I'm willing to accept evidence, and I have many colleagues and friends who have spent a lot of time debunking and actually demonstrating that many of these mediums are frauds. People like the Amazing Randy and other people like Penn Jillette magicians who actually show how these people can use tricks to convince people that they're either talking to the dead or not. And there's many prizes that have been, like the James Randi has given him, offered $1 million for anyone who can convincingly.
Yeah, he did. Now that's been pulled off the table, but nobody ever collected.
Yeah, no one's ever collected it. And I think so. The point is that once again, who am I to say? People get a lot of comfort from these people, but all of the evidence is that these people in general are using the same kind of parlor tricks that magicians use to be able to do things that seem impossible. How could they have possibly known? I've seen Penn Jillette show in Las Vegas, and they do things that just seem impossible. And that's the beauty of magic. So, again, from my point of view, given the evidence, I find it highly unlikely, since there's been no definitively testable evidence presented by any kind of medium of having done this, that it probably isn't happening.
All right, stand with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here with Lawrence Krauss and take final phone calls here. His book, one of them, the latest, the greatest story ever told so far, Why Are We Here? And we bring you these different views on Coast to Coast AM, and you're getting one tonight. So let's come back with our final calls. Those of you who are on hold, just hang right with us. We'll get you when we come back. Don't forget, by the way, to like us on Facebook. Do follow us on Twitter. And if you need to email me, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back. Lawrence Krauss with us, Professor Lawrence Krauss, and your calls as well. Professor, a story just a few days ago that many scientists are beginning to believe that every star system has a binary star system to it, and that ours floated away over millions of years ago, and it's gone out there somewhere. Do you think that's possible?
Well, the idea that there's sort of some hidden nemesis star related to our sun has been around for a while. And
yeah.
Again, there's no evidence of it. There is evidence that there may be large planets, or reasonably large planets, way out beyond our visible solar system, that have highly eccentric orbits. That may be true, but there's no evidence that our sun is part of a binary system. But you're right that most stars in the universe are parts of binary systems, and we've discovered something which maybe 30 years ago we would have thought was impossible, because we discovered that there are planets that orbit binary star systems, and that seems very strange, because with three bodies, what happens is there's a lot of chaos, and we would have expected that there'd be no stable planetary orbits, and eventually the planets would be kicked out of the system. And we've discovered that, in fact, planets do orbit around binary stars. So we're discovering, once again, as I said earlier, that the universe surprises us.
Indeed. And now, some of these other planets that are out there, might they be in our solar system? They're just too far out?
Well, there's one really good bit of evidence that there is at least one planet that's very, very far out in our solar system that has an incredibly eccentric orbit, which means it goes out to an extremely far distance from the sun before coming back in. But by analyzing sort of the gravitational effects that it would have, you could explain the distribution of some of the outer planets and many of the asteroid systems in our solar system. So we think there may be indeed at least one reasonably sized planet that's fairly far out.
Could that be the Planet X that people talk about?
Well, I don't know. Of course, when people talk about Planet X, they mean many different things. This would not have, other than its effect on the outer parts of the solar system, it would not have any significant effects on planet Earth. But if you want to call that Planet X, then you're welcome to.
Let's go back to the calls. We go to Sal in Carson City, Nevada. Welcome to the show. Good morning, Sal.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. George.
Dr. Crouch, I have two questions. First one is just like here on planet Earth, we had a biological computer evolved. So is it possible for a binary computer to evolve out there somewhere? In other words, is there artificial intelligence out there in the universe?
All right, we'll come back to your second question after he's done with this one.
I think the point is that, first of all, if you're going to have artificial intelligence, that means you need the original form, namely, our computers were created by us. And so the big question is, you know, are there other intelligent beings out in the universe that have evolved on their planetary systems? And the answer is, we can't say for sure. But what is true is that it's quite likely, if our civilization survives long enough, which of course will depend on us having some foresight and some abilities we don't seem to have right now to handle ourselves globally, but let's just say we're lucky and survive. Artificial intelligence is evolving at an incredible fast rate. The technology is developing very fast here on Earth, I think there's very little doubt that deep learning intelligent machines will play a greater and greater role in our lives. And it's quite possible someday that there'll be machines that are literally sentient and self-aware and all the rest. And if you think about that, it's probably likely that those machines could evolve at a faster rate than biological beings. So in the far future, the dominant form of intelligence on Earth could be artificial intelligence, namely intelligence that was designed around silicon chips or whatever. And so it could be that when we look out at the universe and we look for sufficiently advanced civilizations, the only ones that are still around are the ones that are computers. So it's certainly a possibility, but they wouldn't evolve on their own, because it turns out silicon and germanium don't have the properties that carbon does to allow the kind of early life forms and replication that appear to have been the case here on Earth. So those kind of life forms, if they exist, if you want to call them life forms, those kind of intelligences would be created by biological systems that evolve.
All right, let's go back to your second question, Sal. Go ahead.
Yes, the second one, Dr. Krause, is that if you could achieve absolute zero, would the result be a computer?
I didn't know. Do you get that?
I understand the question.
Okay.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by that. Absolute zero, in some sense, is not ever physically obtainable because of quantum fluctuations, basically. We can get extremely close. We now can cool systems down to millionths of a degree or almost billionths of a degree above absolute zero. Classically, at absolute zero, all atomic motion stops. But quantum mechanically, what happens is, as I told you earlier, George, there's always fluctuations. And so you can approach it, but never quite get there. But in such a system, if you actually, the closer you get to absolute zero, the less ability you have, if you wish, to do work. Because the kind of work that you'd need to make a computation, because generally you need to go from one system at a higher temperature to another system at a lower temperature to generate useful work.
And, of course, if you're near absolute zero, there isn't much energy left to do anything.
It is truly remarkable what science has been doing. If you had an opportunity, Lawrence, right now to sit down with Albert Einstein, what would you talk with him about?
Well, I think it would be amazing to do, first of all.
It would be.
I think it would be amazing to talk to him about a few things. First of all, that something that he said was perhaps his biggest blunder was actually correct. That in his equations of general relativity, he had a term he called the cosmological constant, which he inserted for the wrong reasons. And he later on said, oh, it was my biggest mistake to have that term. But we now understand that empty space actually has energy, and the dominant energy in the universe resides in empty space. And that energy would give rise to exactly the term that he said was his biggest blunder. So I talked to him about that fact and explained to him that, you know, again, the universe in some sense was smarter than him. But the other question that I'd love to talk to him about, was the question that he really asked himself, which is, is our universe unique? Are there only one set of laws of physics that can exist to have any kind of existence? Or could there be many kinds of laws of physics in many different universes? And he put it in a poetic way. He said, did God have any choice in the creation of the universe? But by God, he didn't mean God, of course. But the question that I think interests both of us is our universe unique? And,
yeah.
And the current wisdom is that we think it probably isn't. We probably think there are many universes, and the laws of physics could be quite different in many of them. And we may even be able to test that idea in the coming years, which, of course, will take metaphysics and turn it into physics.
Would that be astounding if it's proven that there are multiverses? Isn't that amazing?
Of course it's amazing. In a way, it's depressing, in a way. It's amazing and depressing at the same time. Because I grew up as a scientist wanting to explain why the universe is the way it is and why it had to be the way it is. But of course, if there are multiverses, then the universe doesn't have to be the way it is. And once again, our universe could just be an accident, and the properties of our universe have nothing fundamental in them. It's just that they allow life forms like us to exist in them. So in some sense, it's a real come down, but of course, it would really be amazing. It would be a natural continuation of what's happened in physics over the last centuries. First, you know, early days, we didn't know about many of the other planets in our solar system. We didn't know about we didn't realize that the other stars had other solar systems around them. We didn't know about the existence of other galaxies even 100 years ago. Now we know 100 billion galaxies, but in 1925, we knew of only one. So we're learning, of course, that what we think is sort of special unique is just one part of a vast continuum of things. And so it would be a natural continuation to find that even our own universe, which seems so special, is just one of many universes.
East of the Rockies, Lyman is with us, Richmond, Virginia. Hello there, Lyman. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I hope all of you are doing well.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Professor Krauss a question. I'd like to propose, first of all, that I think God is a God of logic and numbers, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I would...
The God of Spinoza, as Einstein would have said.
What
God of Spinoza. He thought of God is basically order in the universe.
My question is, what is the largest finite number? And my next question is, what is the smallest finite number next to zero, which is so small I don't think you could ever get to zero with it?
Well, the answer to both your questions is there is no such number. There's always, for every number, the largest as you want, you can always add one to it and get a larger number. Similarly, between zero and one, there are an infinite number of numbers, rational and irrational numbers. Just take all the fractions, 1/100, 1/1,000, 1/1,000,000. And so there is no smallest number. There is no largest number. There are an infinite number of numbers in both directions.
All right, next up, Morris in Brooklyn, New York, first-time caller. Hello, Morris. Good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. I really appreciate your show, and I appreciate Lawrence Krauss. I must have seen him 1,000 times on YouTube. I just love listening to him.
Great.
Thank you.
I have one problem. I agree with so much of what you say, but I have a bottom-line problem. The examples you give of photons and particles coming from nothing are not coming from absolutely nothing. There's a universe here already.
Yes.
And when I think about it, when I quietly meditate on it and just leave my mind blank, and I'm envisioning a universe, I'm envisioning absolutely nothing. And now there's a universe. It just doesn't make any sense to me that something can come, not from, like, the examples you give of photons and particles, where it's already a universe, but when there's absolutely nothing, how can a universe come from absolutely nothing?
The great thing about physics is that we've learned that things that didn't seem to make sense actually can make sense. We have to expand our notions of what's possible. Now, you're absolutely right. It's really hard to fathom such a picture. But my point is, it doesn't matter that an atom existed. The photon didn't exist before it was created. And what I'm saying is, I don't care what else may exist, but it's possible for our universe, namely everything we see, all the space in our universe, all the matter in our universe, everything that makes up our universe did not exist at one moment and existed at another. That means there was nothing where we are. Our space didn't exist, our time didn't exist, and suddenly it came into existence. Now, was there any precursor? Fine, but there may have been, there may not have been. It could have been, we don't know the answer to that question. But everything we see literally did not exist. And so there was nothing in the sense that the photon wasn't there before it came into existence. Our universe wasn't there before it came into existence. There wasn't any space there for it to exist in. That space literally came into existence. And so that's the sense in which I say they both came from nothing. Whether there was a precursor multiverse and there are other universes out there is irrelevant. Our universe did not exist, and everything we see, feel, touch, and can measure did not exist at one moment and came into existence. And that seems to me to be a pretty good definition of something from nothing.
Are we ever going to be able to travel close to the speed of light?
Well, we can accelerate our elementary particles of the Large Hadron Collider, for example, to 99.999998% the speed of light. But as far as spaceships, it's going to be hard. I'm part of a project funded by Yuri Milner called Breakthrough Starship. We hope to take a 1 gram spaceship and accelerate it using light to 20% the speed of light. And it's at the limit of what we can imagine is possible. But that might be possible. But starships traveling at the speed of light, highly unlikely, or anywhere near the speed of light. It's just the energy required is just too great. Maybe a 1 gram object we might be able to get out there. But starships big enough to hold you and me. That you need more energy than there is in the power output of the sun to do it. And I find it hard to imagine that any advanced civilization would be harnessing the entire energy output of a star just to come here and do weird experiments on abducted people.
Why is Milner into so many things? He's everywhere.
He has a lot of money, and he's interested in funding new and exciting possibilities. And I'm happy that what's happening now is that as government is cutting back, and it's certainly true, especially in this country, that government is cutting back on its funding of fundamental science, which I think is a travesty. It's going to
bite us eventually.
It's going to bite us. That at least certain people who've been the beneficiaries of our financial situation and have made obscene amounts of money are beginning to put some of that money back in to funding programs that the government maybe should have funded in one case or another. So I'm happy that Yuri Milner and Bill Gates and others are
and Musk and all of them
they
deserve it.
And I mean, it's great that they're putting some back. I wish government would follow that realization that, as people have said, and it's true, an analysis has been done that 50% of our current gross national product comes from investments in fundamental curiosity-driven research a generation ago, and if we stop funding that curiosity-driven research now, a generation from now, our children will be suffering.
And I hope they make a fortune doing what they're doing. They deserve it.
Well, fortune or not, I think the main thing is that I hope that they help. You know, the real thing, as one of the directors of the first large particle accelerator in the United States, Fermilab, was asked by Congress in the 1960s whether it would aid in the defense of the nation. And he said, no, but I think it'll help keep the nation worth defending. And ultimately, that's the point. What makes our civilization great isn't the walls we build or the arms we sell to Saudi Arabia or anything else. It's the ideas and the notions that make living and being a human being even more interesting. And that's what we should be thinking about.
Let's go to Gary in Santa Maria, California. Just got a minute for you, Gary. No more, no less. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I'm enjoying the show. And Lawrence, I wanted to ask you, you've explained clearly that our universe is controlled by a series of laws, and I've never known a law that could create itself. I'm just wondering, doesn't this point to the fact that there must be someone that created these laws?
No. No, again, because just once again, things can happen that you're not aware of. But, for example, if universes spontaneously pop into existence, each universe can have different laws that arise as the universe arises. In our universe, the laws of physics change. For example, we're here because a field froze in the early history of the universe called the Higgs field. Before that, the properties of fundamental forces were quite different. They can evolve. And literally, it could be that in different universes, that the laws are quite different. And so there could be an infinite number of laws and an infinite number of universes, and the laws in our universe could just be an accident. And so even if it's not something that you have experienced, the great thing about the universe is that we learn that our experience is myopic, that the universe forces us to expand our mind into what's possible.
No, Lawrence, it was 5 years ago you were last with us. Let's not wait that long again, okay?
Okay, great.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Lawrence Krauss, the name of the book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. We're going to come back in a moment and talk with Shar Margolis, Questions from Earth, Answers from Heaven. Listen to this, a psychic's intuitive discussion of life, death, and what awaits us beyond. So we're going to get the other side next.